Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
A single chilling photo has moved the world and created a major shift on the campaign trail. The image of three-year-old Alan Kurdi washed up on the shore of a tourist beach in Turkey has put a face on the Syrian refugee crisis.
We speak with the uncle of Alan Kurdi about his wife's failed efforts to bring her family to Canada and what he thinks the government should do. We have McLean's political editor Paul Wells to discuss the conservative response to the migrant crisis, and we look into the deep ties the Syrian community has in our country.
This week, it became official. Canada was in a recession for the first half of the year, but recent job numbers show more Canadians have found work, and it raises some doubts about just how deep this contraction goes. To break down the numbers, we speak with CIBC's chief economist, Avery Shenfeld.
We also have David Coletto with Abacus Data to discuss exclusive polling numbers in the latest issue of McLean's, and the McLean's panel discusses the refugee crisis and the beginning of the so-called real election campaign.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Wednesday, a heartbreaking image stopped the world in its tracks. It showed a toddler wearing a red shirt and dark blue shorts, laying lifeless, face down in the sandy shoreline of a Turkish tourist beach, with arms by his side as a wave splashes against his dark hair. His name was Alan Kurdi. The three-year-old had been trying to flee Syria for Greece with his father, Abdullah, his mother, Rahana, and his five-year-old brother, Khalib. The boat they were in capsized, and Abdullah tried to save his family, but his wife and two boys drowned. That picture of young Alan symbolizes the desperation of the millions of people caught in the conflicts of the region.
Word quickly spread that there was a Canadian connection to this chilling image. Alan and Halib's aunt, Tima, lives in Coquitlam, BC. Through her MP, New Democrat Finn Donnelly, Tima had made a written plea to Immigration Minister Chris Alexander to see if she could get her extended family over to Canada. Alexander later explained to CBC he handed the case to officials since he is not allowed to personally get involved in refugee claims. Tima had already tried to sponsor her older brother Mohammed and his family, but they didn't have the proper documentation, so the application was rejected. Tima says it was impossible for Mohammed to get the proper documentation.
She then sent money to Abdullah so he could pay a smuggler to help him take his family out of Syria. That's when they made that fatal trip. I had reached Tima by phone, and she was willing to do an interview, but she broke down in tears before it began and couldn't continue. Instead, I spoke with her husband, Rocco Lagoso. I know it's a difficult time because we're speaking on Friday, and today your nephews have been laid to rest. Have you spoken to Tima's brother, Abdullah, and how is he today?
My wife has spoken to him today. You know, he's very emotional. You know, the gamut of emotions running through him: grief, you know, angry at what's happened. You know, it's part of the process of healing for him. And he just, you know, all he wanted was just to have his family back in her hometown and for him to be with them.
I can't imagine what he is going through, but it must be very difficult for him to have returned to the place he was trying to flee from with his family, who died in that process of escape.
It was. I mean, you know, I met Abdullah back in 2008 when my wife and I went to Syria. You know, he's happy-go-lucky guy, and his little boys were just the same. They're just happy boys. He was a happy-go-lucky guy. And, you know, even throughout all this, he's come out and said, I hope my boys will make a difference now. I hope they help the other Syrian people and everybody else that's been affected by this war.
Can you walk me through what exactly happened when you started the process to try and get Tima's extended family to come over to Canada from Syria?
The process began last year. My wife had made a trip to Turkey to meet up with her family. And when she came back, she, you know, was just appalled by the living conditions that they had. I mean, they couldn't work regularly. So we decided that we would try and bring, you know, the families here. So it was a really long process. Because of it, we decided that we can only sponsor one family, you know, and Tima decided to sponsor her older brother, Mohammed. And so the application was specifically for him. The application was denied when we submitted it. Now, we knew we were going to run into trouble because we know we did not have certain documentation. Like they were not registered as UN refugees, so we needed that. But they simply could not get it. The UN would not offer that. In fact, they would not offer a number because we needed to get some proof from the Canadian government. But the Canadian government wouldn't give us anything because the UN didn't recognize them. So it was a catch-22. So we had help from our MP here, Finn Donnelly. And he contacted Chris Alexander, the Minister of Immigration, about our plight. And along with our application, we sent in some supplementary information. We sent a letter. We wrote about the plight of both brothers and the rest of the family. And Finn handed that off to Chris Alexander. We understand it has to be ruled, but, you know, we're looking for something to help us help the family, bring them over. And so once it was declined, you know, the family, and particularly Mohammed, became despondent and figured his only hope was to leave Turkey and make it to Europe. And in fact, he did that. He left his wife and family behind. So his wife and five kids are in Turkey. And he's now in Germany. He wound up in Germany. And then Abdullah tried to make the same trip. And, of course, we all know what happened.
Do you think that the Canadian government shares some responsibility in the deaths?
I will say that the process of trying to get the family here, the one family first, we found it to be quite onerous and really designed to fail. And so because of that, I think our government has to take responsibility for that and has to share some of the blame, yes. If you're telling me that if we were able to get one of the families here, just one, that would have given hope to the rest. Would they have made that trip? No, they wouldn't. They would not. I believe that very much.
There's been a lot of response from the Canadian political parties. The NDP and Liberals are calling for immediate action. The NDP wants 10,000 Syrian refugees in Canada by the end of the year. The Liberals are calling for 25,000 Syrian refugees to be brought into Canada. The Conservatives say they want 20,000 by 2020. They're also pushing the fact that this can't just be humanitarian aid. There needs to be some military effort to try and deal with some of the problems and the causes for such desperation in the region. What do you think of the responses from the Canadian political parties?
Calling for more refugees to come to Canada, I think, needs to happen. We there's still other families here in Canada, Syrian families or families from Libya, let's say, that have they're just like us. They have families that are trapped, and they can support them. We just got to get them here. We're simply not doing enough. I'm not sure of the number, but we've only allowed 2,300 Syrians in. Millions of them have been displaced. I mean, that's not nearly enough. And I don't think we can wait till 2020. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. We've got to take action now. And as far as the military, I'd say the exact opposite. I think this has totally exacerbated the entire situation. I certainly don't agree with Stephen Harper and his position on regime change in Syria. What has that led to? That has led to what we have today, a war that is causing millions and millions of refugees whose lives are destroyed. I think we need a totally different approach. We need a full diplomatic effort to end the war.
The world will remember your nephew, Alan Kurdi, for this tragic picture of him laying on the beach, a chilling symbol of this refugee crisis and the desperation that people have. But you knew Alan in a way that the world will never know. How will you remember Alan?
Just seeing that little boy lying on that beach, you know, it devastated me just like everybody else, you know. But I'm going to remember him as a happy boy, telling his dad, you know, that he was so happy to leave and we're going to go to Europe, as his dad told him when he got on that boat. He was like his father. He was a happy go lucky boy. And that's how I'm going to remember him. And, you know, you look at him, he's just a beautiful boy that didn't deserve his fate. Sorry.
Don't be sorry. Thank you very much, Rocco. I really do appreciate you talking with us and sharing your thoughts.
Anytime. Thank you.
That was Rocco Lagozzo, whose nephews drowned near Turkey as they fled Syria, sparking worldwide attention to the Syrian refugee crisis.
After the Canadian connection to the photo went public, the crisis was immediately put in the spotlight on the campaign trail. The political debate on the refugee problem is not new. It has been going on for years. But NDP leader Tom Mulcair became emotional addressing it.
This morning we see a little boy getting picked up on a beach. As a dad and a grandfather, it's just unbearable that we're doing nothing. Canada has an obligation to act.
Liberal leader Justin Trudeau claimed the Conservatives have not done enough and are only now waking up to the crisis.
You don't get to suddenly discover compassion in the middle of an election campaign. You either have it or you don't.
Conservative leader Stephen Harper canceled his regular campaign announcement to emotionally address the issue.
You know, the first thing across our mind was, you know, remembering our own son Ben at that age. Running around like that. And I think, I think that is brings tears to your eye.
Harper defended Canada's refugee system, calling it the best in the world, and stressed the need for Canada to continue its mission against ISIS to stop one of the root causes of the displacement.
Now, to discuss the Conservative response, we did request an interview with Immigration Minister Chris Alexander, who is responsible for this file, but he was not available. So instead, we spoke with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, who was on the campaign trail with Stephen Harper.
What he essentially said is the problem of these waves and waves of refugees who are fighting for their lives is so vast that simply accepting refugees is not going to be enough. What you have to do is stop the conditions that are causing refugee waves, and that is the attacks of ISIS against the populations in these countries. His conclusion is, conservatives are right to support the military intervention against ISIS, and the other parties essentially want to only do half of the job. He has decided that he's going to go on the offensive on this.
Is that the right strategy to take in this, in your eyes? We have a family, an aunt and uncle who are here in Canada, who are in tears before the cameras, saying that they believe the process was designed to fail, and that they think the government of Canada shares some responsibility in the deaths here, and they think that war is not the answer, that there needs to be a different approach to all of this. You know, the Conservative leader's strategy seems to be the exact opposite of that. So how do you think this will play out?
The Prime Minister's strategy is likely to be very polarizing. There will be people who find it appalling that he gives a military answer to a humanitarian crisis. But the Conservatives, what's striking about their response is the confidence with which the Prime Minister is presenting it. And I think it's based in the sense that there is an electorate that will agree that if there's millions of people leaving a place, the answer is not to accept more of them. It's to try and keep them from leaving that place by trying to bring ISIS under control. The Conservatives traveling with the Prime Minister tell me that support for the ISIS intervention is high in the population and higher among women than among men.
That was McLean's political editor Paul Wells discussing the Conservative response to this crisis. To read Paul's take on the campaign trail, head to mcleans.ca.
Still to come on the show, we take a deeper look into the Syrian community in Canada and how you can help. We speak with CIBC chief economist Avery Shenfeld about the recession and the latest job numbers, and we have exclusive polling followed by the McLean's panel.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, a chief economist weighs in on the recession and the latest employment figures. We take a look at exclusive polling on the leaders, and the McLean's panel discusses the refugee crisis. But first,
as refugees continue to flee Syria, Canadians are mobilizing with renewed efforts to find private sponsors here in Canada. Cities and provinces are also committing funds to organizations that help refugees resettle. I was able to speak with Ratna Omidvar, the chair of Lifeline Syria, which has received funding from the government of Ontario to help in its efforts.
What are the things that the federal government could do now or in the next, few weeks and months that would speed things up or would make it easier to get people from Syria to here?
Okay, so one of the first things the federal government could do would be to waive the requirement that that any refugee family applying for asylum in Canada needs certification from the UNHCR. This is very difficult to get. The UNHCR is overwhelmed. The UNHCR works under different conditions in different countries. So Turkey, for instance, it's extremely difficult. It's not possible to get UNHCR certification in Turkey, for instance. It's a little easier in Jordan and Lebanon and places like that. But then the other problem kicks in, that our visa officer capacity is simply not there. It takes time to process files. It takes manpower. People have to go through security clearances and medical clearances. Those are important bars to meet, and they can't be done with the current allocation of business as usual. So if the federal government is serious, they have to waive some regulations, they have to put manpower in the ground, and they've got to go back to what they know they have done in the past. They did this with the Indochinese, they've done this with the Hungarians. In those cases, in fact, in Czechoslovakia, Kosovo, even with the Ismailis, we chartered planes. We not only sent visa officers, we chartered private government planes to bring them over.
What specifically should citizens and just, general members of the public be thinking about doing right now?
Well, Canada is the only country in the world that gives private citizens the capacity to sponsor refugees. It's unique in the world. Nobody does it. We've had this since 1978. So citizens can come together in groups of five or more and pull together their financial resources along with their time and their social capital to A, file the paperwork, B, receive the family, C, settle them, and D, look after them for 1 year. It's actually quite complex. Imagine a family arrives in Toronto. You have to go to the airport. You have to have temporary housing for them because you don't know exactly when they will come. You have to help put their kids in school. You've got to help them open their bank accounts, file for a social insurance number, get their health cards. That is a lot of work. And they're responsible for overall well-being of the family for 1 year.
Have you gotten any sense from where you are at that I mean, I guess it's maybe a little bit early to make any conclusions, but that people are responding now more than they were?
Oh, we've been overwhelmed with calls.
Really? Like even just in the last, 24 hours?
Oh, my God. We have training sessions that we host in Toronto. We've just added a number to them. We are completely booked out. The response is overwhelming. People want to do something.
That was Ratna Omidvar, the chair of Lifeline Syria.
Now, many people may not know about the deep ties that the Syrian community has to our country. To find out more, Maclean senior writer Laura Payton caught up with Besma Momani with the University of Waterloo.
Now, you've written a lot about Canada and the Middle East and the contributions of Arab Canadians. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of Syrians in Canada?
Well, it's quite deep and longstanding. In fact, the earliest sort of record that we have of Syrian Canadians is in the late 1800s, many of which settled in Montreal. We had a very large community that also settled in Edmonton. Subsequently, there was a migration pattern that went to the east, Halifax, St. John's. So there really is a very long-standing history between Syria and Canada.
The debate has gotten a little bit emotional this week, obviously, seeing that disturbing photo of the little boy who drowned. What is most important for Canadians to take away from the stories that they're seeing about Syria and Syrian refugees?
Well, I think what people don't realize is that these are in a very educated community that has, unfortunately, been put in the position they are. They're not your labor migrants, and the word migrants is actually one that's offensive because it's really not about people just seeking a better economic opportunity. There is really a real fear for their daily lives, and so they are refugees and seeking asylum, which is not just an important legal distinction, but in many ways it's kind of our morality here of understanding why they're fleeing. And these are, again, very educated people, entrepreneurs, people who I think Canada would value as new and potential citizens. I think this is something that we want in terms of the skill set. They have all the things that would make them easily integrated into our society, and I think very valuable members of our great country. So there's a lot for them to contribute, and I think that our position should be one that looks at them as a potential asset.
Is that similar, or is that different from sort of the original Syrian immigrants who came to Canada?
Yeah, the Syrian immigrants that first came to Canada, many of them went into industries. In fact, some of the old Montreal leather industries were by Syrian Canadians. In the case of many of those that went out east, they were entrepreneurs, small businesses, many of which have now become really well-known Canadian icons. And I think that we're looking at potentially 100,000 Canadians are of Syrian descent. So it's a very interesting pattern, and I think they've done quite a bit of looking into how successful they've been, and they tend to be, on average, not only more educated than, let's say, a Canadian, Canadian-born, which they are, but also in terms of their chances of being more successful tends to be higher than the average Canadian. So I think that we're really bringing, again, people who are an asset to this country as well as potentially helping our country.
That was Maclean senior writer Laura Payton speaking with Besma Momani with the University of Waterloo about the Syrian community in Canada. Maclean's has extensive coverage of the refugee crisis with reports from writers like Scott Gilmore, Jonathan Gatehouse, and foreign correspondent Michael Petru. We've added the issue to our election primer page as well, which gives you a synopsis of the issue, why it matters to you, expert opinions, and how each of the main parties proposes to deal with it. Head to Maclean's.ca to check it out.
Still to come, we speak to a bank economist about the recession and the latest job numbers, and the Maclean's panel discusses the refugee crisis and the start of the real campaign.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we have exclusive poll numbers on the party leaders, and the Maclean's panel weighs in on the refugee crisis. But first,
a spate of economic news resonated through the election campaign this week. A lot of it was, frankly, tricky to interpret. First, Canadians heard that the economy was in recession for the first half of 2015, but growth in the month of June looked promising. Next came Statistics Canada data showing the unemployment rate was up in August, but somehow that might be good news. To make sense of it, Maclean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes asked Avery Schoenfeld, chief economist at CIBC, to explain what the numbers really mean. Schoenfeld started off with the latest jobs data.
Well, sometimes actually a rise in unemployment is good news because it can come two ways. It can come because people who were employed lost jobs on balance, or as is the case with the August data, it can come more favorably because people who weren't even looking for work start to look, and while they're looking, they're counted as unemployed. So we actually had a decent rise in total employment. There were a lot of full-time jobs in that mix as opposed to part-time work, and the good news on hiring may have drawn some people into the job hunt who weren't doing so before.
So people get the message in their own, wherever they live, that, hey, some people are getting new jobs, maybe I'll start looking again.
It may well be that there's been so much pessimism about the Canadian economy that when people on the ground here in their local region that there are, in fact, jobs out there, they start applying, and these could be people who weren't applying before.
Is there anything we know about either the regions or sectors where this decent bounce in employment has happened?
The one negative here is that if we trace it back to the beginning of the year, so we don't just look at one monthly survey, but the underlying trend, a lot of the job creation in Canada has come from the public sector. Now, those are good jobs, teachers, hospital workers, and so on, but you can't grow an economy forever by having everyone work for the government or a branch of the government. You need a private sector, of course, to generate the tax revenues. That's that pays for all that. And we really have not seen much private sector hiring since the start of the year. So that's an underlying sign that not all is entirely well with the Canadian economy.
Interesting. I noticed, though, I hate to bury people in statistics here, but I noticed also, though, thinking about the private sector part of the economy, that merchandise exports were up for July, another number we had this week. Yeah, any thoughts on that, Avery? Is that a cause for optimism?
We are looking at a host of data that suggests that we're getting a breather from the bad news when we look at the third quarter. So the first half of the year, there was nothing much to cheer about in the Canadian economy, but in June, we had a lift to both output and exports, and July showed actually a further build, not only in the value of what we sold to the rest of the world, but the volume, you know, how much we were selling.
That's important, Dave.
And that's important because that's what actually feeds into those GDP numbers that everyone later pays attention to. So given the boost from trade and reasonable news from hiring, the fact that Canadians got a big check from Ottawa, at least Canadians with families at the start of the quarter, there's enough evidence out there that gives us some comfort that the third quarter, at least, will show a return to positive economic growth.
Could I just take you back? You mentioned the numbers we had on GDP. Again, people just listening to the newscast might have heard, well, Canada was in what's sometimes called a technical recession, that basically the economy shrank in the first two quarters of this year. But then the other message, which was coming up on the campaign trail, was that June was a more buoyant kind of month. Can you give us just a little perspective on that? Does that just mean that the effect of the oil slump sort of worked its way through the economy in the first couple of quarters and now we're turning the corner, or how would you see that?
Well, we don't know if we're turning the corner for good or only getting a breather from bad news that could then revert again. But we did end the second quarter numbers. You get both a number for the whole quarter, but also actually a reading on just what the last month looked like.
Which was June.
Which was June, and the last month looked good. It was actually quite a strong gain. So some of the sectors that we were hoping to benefit from the weaker Canadian dollar seem to be getting a little bit of a lift in June. That may be why the trade numbers for June, our export numbers, also looked better. And at least for now, that's a counterweight to the drag we still have from the downsizing in the energy sector. The question mark will be, of course, whether that still holds up when we get into the winter or even the fall, whether we still have enough momentum in the rest of the economy to offset what's still a pretty troubling picture for the oil side of the economy.
And so just to back again, how much do you think the cheaper Canadian dollar has been a factor in that, as you say, that sort of sense of respite, the idea that the bad news was easing off there in maybe June, July? Is that really the effect of the cheap dollar making Canadian exports more competitive in U.S. and other markets?
If we actually look at the export data back to the beginning of the year, while the overall picture wasn't great, the sectors within our economy that tend to benefit from a weaker Canadian dollar were actually showing a general uptrend. And the impact of the weaker Canadian dollar should show through, but it's going to be coming in drips and drags. This could take years to play out in terms of getting the full benefit of a weaker exchange rate.
Really? Years? That's just because, what, people need that much time to get used to to readjust what they think a Canadian product is worth, or how does that, why would it take so long?
Unfortunately, when the Canadian dollar was strong, so really the whole period from 2010 to 2013, a lot of manufacturers shut their doors permanently in Canada. So those plants are not waiting to be sparked back to life now that the currency is cheaper and our workers are cheaper relative to those in the U.S. We're going to need to sustain a weak Canadian dollar for several years in order to actually attract new investments in new manufacturing facilities that choose Canada as a location. And those location decisions don't come up every day. And we're hoping that with the Canadian dollar at this sort of level, Canada can now once again compete for those new investments.
That's so interesting. Avery, I don't want to drag you into being a political commentator. I know you're an objective chief economist of a major bank, but we are in a campaign. Do you think that campaign climate through the fall then is, as far as the economy goes, is it going to be a sort of an economy that's on the edge between being promising and worrying, or what, how do you feel that the fall is going to look in terms of, you know, as we get economic data regularly? Will it look buoyant, or will it look like it may be like we're in trouble?
We'll get a dose of reasonable news, but it's not going to be anything that erases some of the concerns we had through the first half of the year. And certainly people in Alberta will know that their economy is not sparking magically back to life again. So I don't think the political climate will be that different on voting day than it is today, and Canadians are going to have to decide which party they trust to set the policy levers at the right levels, given the economic context.
That was CIBC Chief Economist Avery Shenfeld in conversation with Maclean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes.
In this week's issue of Maclean's magazine, we had some exclusive polling done on the party leaders. One of the sections of the poll focuses on a variety of who would you rather questions, such as who would you rather have babysitting your kids or cooking you a meal. The questions may seem funny, but they speak to the type of trust that voters have with each of the leaders. David Coletto with Abacus Data breaks it all down.
We had asked this earlier in 2015 in January, and we wanted to see if there was some change. And the same trends emerged, although Mr. Mulcair, like in everything, has been doing better in these types of questions than he was in January 2015. But what we learned was that when it comes to socializing, as you said, cooking the best meal, choosing the best movie to watch, babysitting your kids, being around, somebody you want to be around, Mr. Trudeau comes well ahead of the two other leaders. He's the guy, he's the leader that you want to hang out with, that you think is inspiring, that can inspire Canadians, can set a good example, and probably can give you good recommendations on a good movie to watch. But he trails both Mr. Harper and Mr. Mulcair on some of the more, I guess, serious leadership type attributes. So who would make the best CEO of a large company? Mr. Harper slightly ahead of Mr. Mulcair. Who do you trust to give the advice to your children? Well, Mr. Mulcair comes ahead of both Mr. Harper and Trudeau on that question. And one of, I think, the more interesting questions was, who would you prefer to negotiate a contract on your behalf? So it's not just trust about, you know, recommendations for food or movies, but actually be an advocate for you. And Mr. Mulcair comes ahead there, and he's gained in that measure since January. So I think it does show that even though these are somewhat superficial, they do demonstrate, I think, how the leaders are positioned. Trudeau's the guy you like. Mr. Mulcair's, I think, going to be a strong advocate, somebody you would trust, whereas Mr. Harper is a little less trusted, but is seen as a strong, stable kind of voice who has some reason behind it. One other interesting new question we asked that I think shows how Canadians feel about the three leaders, we asked, which of the leaders do you think is most likely to forget their spouse's birthday? And, unfortunately for Mr. Harper, he comes well ahead of the other two leaders, which is only indicative, I think, of the challenge the Conservatives have, that people are conflicted about Mr. Harper. They see him as a strong, stable leader, but on the other hand, they don't really like him, and they don't really think he's empathetic towards others and therefore themselves.
Now, David Coletto also got some surprising results when he checked out how well voters know the leaders, and participants also gave some interesting answers when asked to use one word to describe each leader. To check out the complete poll results, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine or head to macleans.ca.
Coming up after the break, the Maclean's panel weighs in on the refugee crisis and the rest of the election campaign.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by the new face at Maclean's, a senior writer Laura Payton, and Maclean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes.
The old face.
Yeah, right. Thanks very much for joining me. We'll start off by discussing this refugee crisis, a tragic, tragic story with the photo of the young child, the toddler, washed up on the shore, but it's really opened up the eyes to a lot of the public around the world and here in Canada about this crisis. I'm going to look at the political response from the Conservatives first, and then we'll look at the opposition. When the government was in power, we heard the story about how this process unfolded for the aunt trying to get her extended family over here and the problems she faced. How do you think, John, first, the Conservatives handled this as a government, and then their response to this on the campaign trail, increasing it by 10,000 refugees, their quota, so 20,000 by 2020.
That preceded the crisis, right?
We should
be clear. They had already announced the increase before then. So it's not like that was a response.
But they're sticking with that, and they're not wavering from that plan as their response. So, John, we'll start off with you. What do you think of this so far?
Well, the response, I think the Prime Minister's response was very heartfelt, right? He took it as a moment to put a very personal take on it, referred to being a father and seeing the picture in that context. So that was one element of it that was interesting. I saw it as sort of having two angles. Right? The Prime Minister's out saying, we feel for this, it's an emotional situation. And then they had Chris Alexander trying to talk a little bit more precisely about, you know, what the policy difficulties are. So it's sort of a two-stage report response, right? Seem empathetic and emotional about it. I'm sure people are emotional about it. But then also try to frame it in terms of a difficult policy file to handle. You know, I think I pity Canadians out there trying to piece together all the different elements. There's different categories of refugees and asylum seekers. There are refugees coming from Iraq, where Canada's done quite a better job of incorporating people than they have from Syria. There's a lot of elements to the story. So I would say that the question politically right now is, do people ultimately buy the line of the government, which can be boiled down to something like, it's very hard to move people quickly out of those refugee camps, particularly in Turkey to Canada. We've got a fairly big quota, we're doing our best. Or do they buy the opposition line, which is too little, too slow, and Canada could be doing much more? You know, that's where the political debate now flows, right?
Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated debate anyway, and then it's also kind of in the government's interest to mix in all these extra things, and we see that when the Prime Minister kind of moves off of the refugee response and into ISIS and the need to fight Islamic State militants, right? And you know, the numbers show that Syrians are more at risk of dying because of the Assad regime than because of ISIS. But the Canadian government likes to focus on that because they do really well in the polls when they're talking about ISIS and terrorism. And so despite the fact that this week we're talking about refugees, I don't know that what Stephen Harper said was necessarily in response to the refugee crisis.
But he's filling in the narrative, or at least extending the narrative that he's had from the start of this campaign. He came out and said this campaign is going to be about the economy, and it's going to be about foreign policy, and specifically ISIS out of that. And that sort of flows with the narrative he's had throughout this whole campaign.
Go ahead.
In fact, the numbers that we have from Abacus Data this week show that the Prime Minister is head and shoulders above NDP leader Tom Mulcair and Liberal leader Justin Trudeau when it comes to perceptions on the world stage. Who is most likely to represent Canada well in foreign policy? I can't remember how it was exactly phrased.
He's much higher in terms of cutting deals with foreign leaders or representing Canada internationally. He does much better. It's interesting, though, because there's that mantle that he has. And he has tended to do better in the polls, really going back to early 2014, whenever there's foreign news whenever foreign news is dominating, whether it be Russia or the Middle East. The Prime Minister's numbers tend to tick up. So he's got to like that. On the other hand, this issue maybe cuts against another part of his reputation is he doesn't get a lot of high scores for empathy. Abacus also asked a bunch of questions to say, like, who do you think is kind of feels good about things? Who's inspirational? Who would you trust to talk to your children? He doesn't do well on that. So how will this story be cast? Will it be cast as a question of who's a hard-nosed Canadian leader on the foreign stage or who's an empathetic leader who reflects the feelings that Canadians have in a moment like this? Could go either way, right?
What do you think of the political decision to stick by their previous promise of only increasing by 10,000 after this tragic photo came out that pulls on the heartstrings? And you talk about empathy, that's really what voters may be wanting at this time, seeing such a tragic photo like that. But the Prime Minister, Conservative leader Stephen Harper, is sticking with his plan.
I guess one point of that is that they haven't gotten very many refugees into Canada so far from particular Syrians who've ended up in Turkey. So to dramatically increase your numbers now when you haven't been doing much in terms of making good on your previous promises, they didn't hit their target for, if memory serves, 1,300 refugees last year. They got about 700. You know, they haven't been hitting their target. So to suddenly increase your target in the wake of this emotional week of news, I think that would have seemed a little hollow. So maybe prudent to not, you know, try to jump in with a new number when you're not really making good on your old numbers. What do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, I would think it's probably responsible not to immediately pivot and throw out a number that you haven't really thought out. Even the opposition parties, or the Liberals and the NDP were talking about, like, they kind of stuck with their previous pledges, the numbers that they had talked about last spring during the debate on extending the military mission. And they didn't really go out of their way to talk about much bigger numbers.
And that brings us to the opposition. They're facing challenges right now with questions of how much would it cost and how would you actually get 10,000 refugees in before the end of the year under the NDP plan, or 25,000 under the Liberals, try and get them in quickly. There's a cost and there's a process to try and fast track that many people, and possibly even some security issues that pop up with that. Have you seen any details from the opposition on these problems?
None. And I think, unfortunately, this takes us into some very thick weeds, right? I've been reading up on what some people from Boston University's law school have found about the process in Turkey, and they're essentially reporting a centralized, quite authoritarian response from the Turkish government to processing refugees there. Now, it's complicated. The Turks have been very generous about allowing almost 2 million refugees to come into their country. They can't be faulted for that. But the process that's in place there is not being directed by the UN, it's being directed by the Turkish government, and it's proven to be a slow process. So for anyone to come out and say, hey, we'll bring many thousands more refugees in than are currently coming, I think you at some point want to ask them, okay, what's your understanding of how you're going to fast-track that process on the ground, particularly in Turkey, but also other places in the region?
Yeah. In fairness to the NDP, they have said that they said this week, that they would send more civil servants, more citizenship and immigration officials into the region to help fast track these things. But then I think you have to ask, how easy is it to get some, you know, a big crop of civil servants to pick up and move to Beirut or Ankara in these countries where it might also be hard simply to get them accredited? Like, how do you set
and
up
to
that
ask for cooperation from Turkey, which has not been, again, I'm not faulting Turkey here, they're taking a lot of refugees in, but they have not been well regarded so far for having streamlined these processes.
All right, so foreign policy and the refugee crisis is in the spotlight right now. But over the past month, we've seen the Duffy trial and questions around Senate spending in the spotlight. We've seen the economy come up recently because of the recession that Canada hit in the first half of this year, and the issue over deficits or keeping the books balanced. As we move into what some are calling the real campaign after Labor Day, when people really get back to work and start paying more attention to the news and start to pay more attention to the campaign just before they cast their ballots, do you think that this foreign policy issue will stay in the spotlight and take a totally different shift, Laura, for the campaign? Or do you think that these other issues that have popped up will continue as themes throughout?
Well, it's interesting because you don't tend to think of Canadian elections as having foreign affairs as a turning point. You know, like, generally people don't really think very much. They think about trade maybe and about jobs, but they don't necessarily think about aid or humanitarian policy. So at the same time, we've talked about the emotion of that disturbing photo of the child, and people seem to really be coalescing around it. So, I mean, it could have some traction, but I also think that if there's nothing to sustain that, if there's no new developments, like, we'll probably see it head back more into an economic story in this campaign.
Best laid plans, eh? Justin Trudeau last week thought he had thrown the campaign into a totally new dynamic by saying he would run deficits, whereas the NDP is lumped in with the Tories among the austerity-minded budget balancers. You know, pivoting, swinging way out left of the NDP. And I think the Liberals justifiably thought, well, that will dominate the campaign for a few days, at least now, if not a few weeks. So there'll be a reorientation people think about in that context. Instead, they get a couple of days of interest in that, and then this horrific story from a beach in Turkey overwhelms that. And that, what looked like a sort of game-changing moment, is at least pushed to the back burner for the time being. It'd be interesting to see if it sort of comes again into the spotlight. And we had three big important economic numbers this week. Recession in the first half of the year, unemployment up in August, and then less prominently played, but interesting, merchandise trade up in the summer so far for Canada, so sort of a good number in there. All this economic data coming, which in a dull week on the campaign would have been fodder for lots of questions and lots of debate, mostly forgotten in this week where we're focusing instead on a tragedy in the Eastern Mediterranean.
All right, thanks very much, guys. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, McLean's Senior Writer Laura Payton, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode. Remember to check out the other McLean's podcasts, The Thrill about pop culture and Bibliopod about books.
But for more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.